Lovely to be here. Let me help you right from the start. If you want to find Ecclesiastes, it's Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. I remember years ago I was in a Bible study group and someone gave a reference, and I think it was Zechariah or Joel or something like that. And I was flipping through my Bible and I thought, strike, I can't find it. And it was taking a bit long, and everybody else had found it. I thought, well, I'm the pastor, I should know where it is, so I'll just hold my Bible here and look like I've got it. And then someone said, John, would you read the first verse? I thought, oh dear. And well, it's Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, so please find it, and we'll be able to look at it together. The approach of Ecclesiastes is an approach that is very, very important, I think, in the kind of world you and I live in. It says things in a way that we don't normally say them, but it says things in a way that we need to learn to say them. For my money, if you asked me which was the most contemporary book in the whole of the Bible, I'd say it's Ecclesiastes, the most contemporary book in the whole of the Bible. And yet it's not a book that we use very much, partly because when you start to look at it, you think, oh dear, this is a bit drab or negative. It's a bit repetitive. Hard to know where we even fit in it. Well, I'm hopeful that over the weekend we'll be able to see where we fit and better how Ecclesiastes fits on us and on our world. It's a long time ago since Francis Schaeffer wrote a book called Death in the City. Let me read you just a paragraph from the book. He says, there is a time, and ours is such a time, when a negative message is needed before anything positive can begin. People often say to me, what would you do if you met a really modern man on a train and you had just an hour to talk to him about the gospel? Schaeffer answers, I would spend 45 or 50 minutes on the negative to show him his real dilemma, to show him that he is more dead than he thinks he is. Then I would take 10 or 15 minutes to tell him the gospel. Unless he understands what is wrong, he will not be ready to listen to and understand the positive. Now, the man who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes would stand up and cheer, I think, if he heard Francis Schaeffer say that, because that's exactly what he does. He spends time on the negative to show people that they are really more undone than they think they are before he starts to give them the answer. We are often very good with the answers. We've got them all. We've got a Bible full of them. And we tend to drop them on people fairly readily and fairly happily. But we wonder why people don't want to hear them. Because we haven't undone them first, that they might be done up with what God says. And the book of Ecclesiastes is a great book for undoing you. It's a great book for exposing things as they really are. A great book for showing us what the world's really like. Now, as I say, that's not a very popular approach. If I've got pain, I don't want more pain. I want less. That's why I go to the doctor. If I go to the doctor and he says, well, you're sore, well, I'm going to make it sorer. Well, I say, thanks, I'll change doctors. I don't want that sort of doctor. I want relief. I want release from the pain. Whether it's emotional pain, I mean, you talk to people. Some of you are involved in counselling people. And if people are in a painful situation and you tell them to go this way and it's going to mean more pain, they'll run a mile by nature. Nobody wants more pain, we want less. We want things easier, not harder. When you speak to someone who's troubled in some way, they want relief. They don't want it to be harder. The book of Ecclesiastes, brethren, makes it harder before it makes it easier. It does make it easier. It gives the most marvellous answers to a meaningless world. But it says, firstly, do you see how meaningless the world really, really is? The technique of the preacher, that's what he is. The name Ecclesiastes is just really a kind of a translation of the Hebrew word, the preacher. It's a sermon, the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, I don't know about you, but I think sermons shouldn't come in half measures. Do you agree? You don't come for 20 minutes one day and go home and let the preacher preach the rest, the other 20 minutes. You don't come next week halfway through and miss the first 20 minutes and come for the second 20 minutes. You get it in the whole. Well, the book of Ecclesiastes is a sermon, and it's meant to be heard in one go. That's why it's a great book for a weekend like this. It wasn't my choice, I might add. It was Don McMurray, so you can blame him that we're looking at something that's painful. But it's a great book. It's meant to come in one hit. And hopefully the weekend will give us the opportunity to look at the sermon that this preacher preaches in one hit, as it were. Well, let's start where he starts. He wants to speak to modern man, and he says, first of all, life in a closed world is meaningless. Now, let me tell you why I've got that heading. You may think it's a strange thing to talk about a closed world. Through the book of Ecclesiastes, the preacher uses a term and talks about life under the sun or life under heaven. It's a phrase that comes, I think, nearly 30 times I counted in the book. Life under the sun means life as you can see it. What you just see around you, what you can touch, what you can smell, what you can work out with your mind, things that you can work out logically, observations you can make. What you see is what you get. That's life under the sun. And when the writer of Ecclesiastes, when the preacher says life under the sun is murder, he's saying life in a world that is a world that you can just see, a world that you can just smell but no more, a life in a world which you can understand but not, that doesn't go beyond your understanding, life in that kind of world is meaningless, futile, awful. But that's the kind of world people today want. We don't want God above the sun, as it were. We don't want a Bible that comes from behind the sun somewhere to this world. We just want the world under the sun. What you see, what you work out, what logic tells you, what the academics teach you, what you believe intuitively. That's life under the sun. But I tell you, life under the sun, life in a closed world, where the only facts you can believe are the facts you can see and understand, is meaningless. The preacher's conclusion, now I don't know how you do, if you're if you write essays for university or school or TAFE, or if you do math sums, normally you do all your arguments and you put your conclusion at the bottom. Well, the preacher's a bit different, good Hebrew. He puts his conclusion first, and then he gives you the reasons why he got to his conclusion. So his conclusion in chapter 1, verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the preacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. So this sounds a promising set of studies this weekend. But he's talking about life under the sun. Life in a world where there's no God, it has no meaning. The word simply means futile. Nothing. It's like when you men next do the washing up and you're over the sink and all the bubbles are there and you burst the bubble and you've got nothing left. That's the picture. Nothing left, you burst it. And there's nothing underneath. It's just a vapour. Everything is a vapour. Nothing has any substance. Nothing has any real answer in a world under the sun. And the preacher says, that's what life's like. Life is very, very ordinary when you look at it. Life is very, very mundane and daily. Life is very, very repetitive. Life has nothing in it, he says. Take a look. Verse 5, at the sun. What do you see the sun do? In the morning, it gets up. In the night, goes back. Next morning, gets up. Next night, goes back. Next morning, gets up. Next night, round and round, round and round, round and round. That's what it does. That's what the sun does to our mind as we see it. What about the wind? Verse 6. Well, the wind blows from here to here and then turns around and comes back and then blows up again and round and round and round and round it goes, he says, ever returning. All the air currents are moving around, but nothing's ever new. Going round this year as they did last year and the year before and last century and last millennium, round and round, round and round. What about the water, verse 7? Well, old streams flow into the sea. Down the water comes from the rain, falls into the side of the mountain, down the stream, out to the sea, up it goes, round, round, up and down, round. That's what life's like, he says. The sun does it, the wind does it, the water does it. It might look new the first time you go to Ayers Rock and see a sunset over Ayers Rock. It takes your breath away. It's so new. But it's only new to you. It's been doing that for a long, long time. The first time you go to a Tasmanian National Park and see the waterfall, you say, oh, this is breathtaking. But it's been falling over there for a long time. It's only new to you. It's been going down and round and down and round and up and down and up and down for a long time. He says, that's what life's like, you see. That's what it's like. Nothing's new. Verse 9, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Always a bit disheartening, I think, to be an inventor. You spend your life inventing something and you say, here it is. And someone scratches his head and said, oh, the Greeks about 2,000 years ago. Well, it takes the heart out of things a bit, doesn't it? But nothing's new. Nothing's new. It's all been there before. And as Thomas Edison, the great inventor, said, inventors don't do anything except bring out the secrets of nature. They're not inventing anything. They're not making anything new. They're just bringing out what's there. It's been going round and round, up and down, round and round, up and down for a long, long time. Advertisers, of course, tell you that life's not like that, don't they? They say you can break the cycle. You can break out, wear this lipstick, and life will be new. Well, it's been going round and round, up. The Romans were wearing lipsticks well before we even were thought of. The advertisers say, move out of this way of life, get this possession, do this, get that job, and life will change. No, says the preacher. No, not in your life. Round and round, up and down. The preacher is much, much more realistic than the advertising man. Chapter 1, verse 8, all things are wearisome. More than one can say. You can talk about things till the cows come home, he says, but it's just what we all know in our heart of hearts. Nothing ever really changes. There's a French saying, the more things change, the more they turn out to be the same. The more things change, the more they turn out to be the same. Well, that's what the preacher says. You see things that look like they're changes, but in reality, things keep going round and round, up and down. Now, it's not only advertising men who want to kid us that it's not like that. We somehow think that we've got to say it's not like that if we're Christians. We somehow think maybe we've got to defend God. Maybe the world's better than that. We don't see the humdrumness of life. And we somehow think that we really ought to pretend that it's better. And many of the people who are seeing the world realistically, in its stark awfulness, a world without God, are people who are not Christians. Sad to say, but people who are artists and writers and playwrights, they are saying that life is murder. We somehow think that we ought to say the opposite. But the preacher's got it right. He says all is meaningless. All is vaporous. Other people besides Christians have been saying it for a long time. You can go back a couple of thousand years to Marcus Aurelius. He was a Stoic philosopher. He says, they that come after us will see nothing new. And they who went before us saw nothing more than we have seen. Nothing's new under the sun. Round and round, up and down. Be a bit more contemporary for a minute. There are hundreds of thousands, probably millions, of people who are in teenage years who've seen it in the way their parents don't. You've spoken to some of those millions, and they say, you think I'm going to get into life Dad's got? You've got to be joking. Goes to work, drives home, eats tea, goes to bed. Goes to work, comes home, eats tea, goes to bed. Who wants that? And who can blame them for saying who wants that? Fancy getting locked into that kind of life. Drive to work, drive home, eat, go to bed. Drive to work, drive home, eat. Great, round and round, up and down, round and round, up and down. Look, who'd want that sort of life, says the preacher. It's a meaningless sort of life. Brethren, that's what the world is like. That's what life is like in a world where there is no God. That's life in a world under the sun. Things look different, but nothing is different. Things look new, but nothing is new. It's been doing it for thousands of years, says the preacher. Nothing new under the sun. I tell you, don't close your eyes to what's real. That's what it's really like. Some of you will have read A Streetcar Named Desire. And in that, there's a character, Blanche, and she just says, I don't want realism, I want magic. Well, sorry, Blanche, you've got to have the real, the reality. And the reality is, that's what life's like. That's really what it's like. Well, one other quote that I read somewhere, some graffiti on a wall of the university in Britain, and it said, do not adjust your life, the fault lies in reality. Don't adjust your life as if somehow thinking that moving your life around is going to get things right. The problem is life is a mess. And we ought to say, yeah, that's right, instead of rushing in to say, oh no, it's not that bad. It is that bad. Life in a world under the sun where there is no God, and there is no God who draws near and no God who speaks, is absolutely meaningless, just a vapour. What are the answers then, if that's what life's like? And people in their more honest moments will say it. My father-in-law, whom I love and respect more than almost any man I know, he's not a Christian, but I love him and respect him greatly. He's a brilliant man. He's the first man at Adelaide University to be awarded Doctor of Science and Doctor of Philosophy, written many fine papers in his field of inorganic chemistry, devoted his whole life to science. And one night a few years ago, I remember very sadly, he said, I used to think science had all the answers. Now I see it doesn't answer the most simple question of all. Didn't say what it was. He said it doesn't even answer the simplest questions. What do you do in a world like that? He saw it a whole life devoted to something that now provided no real answers. He'd gone to bed, driven to work, taught students, come home. Gone to bed, driven to work, taught students. Round and round, up and down, round. Well, for what? Where are the answers along the way? Well, what are the answers in a closed world? Well, I tell you, not only is the world meaningless, but answers in a closed world are meaningless. Now, plenty of people are giving the answers, trying to, but let me tell you that they are meaningless answers. Again, the preacher gives his conclusion first before he tells you what answers he tried. Verse 14 of chapter 1. He says, I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Sorry, I missed verse 13. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. I've seen that it's all meaningless. Right? I tried all the answers under heaven that you can try, and I came to the conclusion not one of them has any substance. Not one. Now, let me tell you, brethren, he's a good scientist, though, this preacher. Because he doesn't sit down in his study one day and say, oh, I've got to preach a sermon on Sunday on Ecclesiastes and on the world. I'll give thought for a couple of minutes to the sort of answers people try, and I'll say, no, they're no good. No, he says, I actually tried them. I tried the answers. And as the preacher goes through these next few verses, you see that he spent years and years and years trying the answers. They didn't just come out of his head. He got in there and gave them a go. And his conclusion is, not one of them has any substance. He's a good scientist. He's done the experiments and he's tried hard. His first experiment was with philosophy, if we can call it that. The ideas that people talk about and discuss. Chapter 1, verse 15, he says, What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. He says, I found out there were just too many hard questions I couldn't get the answers to. I got the answers to some, but the hard ones I couldn't get answers to. Such twisted questions. Questions, I suppose, like, if we were to put ourselves in his place, when I look at this world, how do I work it out? That some people are greedy and complacent and living in awful luxury. And there are 45,000 children a day starving to death. Come on, philosopher, work that one out. He says, I couldn't. When I look at my child who gets leukemia and dies at the age of 3 and a half, what's the answer to that one? What will I hang on to when I'm faced with that? No, thousands of questions that don't have any explanations. No explanations, at least, that satisfy. In a closed world, brethren, where the only information you can get is from what you see and what you hear, there isn't enough information. In a closed world, there isn't enough information to answer those questions. You won't know enough. You won't see enough. You won't be able to look under the microscope and get enough facts to answer questions such as those. No, he says, there's no answers going down the road marked philosophy. Simply not enough information. And there's a sting in the tail. There's a sting in the tail of that one. In verse 18, and I hope you feel the weight of this, because I tell you, brethren, this is where many non-Christian people are at. And we need to be a bit more sympathetic than often we are. We say, oh, these people trying to get all these answers to themselves, they're fools, and we just write them off, end of subject. But he says, verse 18, for with much wisdom comes sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. It's almost a case of this, that the more you ask the questions to get answers to the pain, the more you ask questions that are painful, the less you get answers that satisfy, the greater the pain of the question. The more you're perplexed about something and you long for an answer and you don't get it, the pain becomes greater, it becomes more intense. And there are plenty of people in a situation like that. It's almost a case, in a sense, that it's true that ignorance is bliss. Almost true. That's not right, of course. But there's a sense in which it's easier not to ask the painful questions. It reminds me of a teacher who sent a school report home to some parents. And he said to them, if ignorance is bliss, your child will have a very happy life. Well, it's almost a case that, as one writer put it, the more you understand, the more you hurt. The more you see that there are no answers, the greater the pain. The more you understand, the more you ache. As we said, the more you understand, the more you ache. And there are playwrights and novelists and poets who aren't Christians, and you see that ache all the way through what they write. We need to understand what it's like. We need to make the pain greater. We might provide, like Schaefer says, that answer which is right at the end. Well, that's the first thing that the preacher tried. He says, I tried wisdom or philosophy. I don't think it's biblical wisdom here, but human philosophy. He says, just couldn't work it out. Didn't get an answer. And the more I saw, the more I hurt. He says, I tried pleasure. In chapter 2, I thought in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what is good. I'll go and have a good laugh. I'll make sure I enjoy some picnics. I'll do things that just make me feel good. But he says, that also proved to be meaningless, empty. Laughter, I said, is foolish. Because you go to the party, you laugh yourself silly, but you wake up the next morning and you've still got the same problem. Laughter doesn't answer anything. Now, he doesn't say laughter is wrong. He says laughter is foolish if you're looking to laughter to provide the answers. He does not say laughter is wrong. Hope nobody goes out of here today saying, oh, we've got to sort of be like this from now. No, no, he's not saying that. But if you think the answers lie in laughter, he says you're fooling yourself. Laughter is foolish. I tell you, Solomon had money to burn. He could hire the best comics, rent the funniest videos if he had the opportunity, and all that. He said, I tried everything, anything that money could buy. And he said, there was no answer there. No substance in pleasure or laughter, he says. Some of you are old enough, if I look around, a few grey hairs here, you're old enough to remember Tony Hancock, who was a very funny man. One of the funniest comedians, I should think, that Britain has produced. He knew how to laugh, and he knew how to make other people laugh. At the height of his career, he had 30% of the British population watching his show every week. That's popularity for you. He had much going for him. And through his life, his friends said, people like Spike Milligan and Kenneth Taylor and others, they said he was one of the most troubled men that had ever lived. And after he would perform at night, he'd come back and he'd sit down with his friends and he'd talk for hours and hours, 3, 4, 5 o'clock the next morning, to try and find out, what's the point of it all, he'd say. What's the point of it? Where's it all going? He wanted to find out real answers to real questions. And of course, he, in the end, committed suicide. The pain became too much. He was asking the questions. He knew the pain of unanswered questions, and the pain became too great. And he opted out. And as Spike Milligan says of him, one by one he shut the door on all the people he knew. Then lastly he shut the door on himself. It's sad. Tony Hancock's biography came out in about 1985, written by two men, one of whom was his son. And this is what they said. You listen to these words. This is for a man who laughed a lot. And he knew how to make others laugh. He said this, these two authors, it may be that Hancock eventually managed to see himself in the cosmic perspective he'd sought for years, as an insignificant speck of dust in an obscure corner of the universe, the end product of a long line of accidental survivals. That's a realistic man who lives without God. That's the only conclusion. They conclude this. Listen to this sentence. Last sentence. It is one thing to talk about the need for perspective. It must be unbearable to find it. He can laugh the night before, but once the party's over and he sees himself as he really is and he has no answers, it was unbearable. Now listen, I tell you, you listen to these fellows. You don't have to go where they've been. Solomon said, I tried it all. Hancock says, I tried it all. And it's not there. So don't be a fool. Learn the lesson. I don't have to get AIDS to find out that AIDS isn't very attractive. I can see those who've got it. Learn the lesson, says the preacher. Don't go down the road marked philosophy that says, here is the answer to life. Don't go down the road marked pleasure saying, here is the answer to life. It's not there. I'll tell you, says the preacher, I've tried it. I've run all the experiments. He tried a third road. He tried what we could simply call culture. In chapter 2, verse 4, I undertook great projects. He's still saying what he's tried to find out where there's meaning in a meaningless world. I built houses for myself, planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water growth. It's a, as one writer says, it was like a secular Garden of Eden. It was beautiful. Just beautiful, a secular Garden of Eden. He tried the arts. He tried agriculture. He tried architecture. All those good things. And they are good things. But any answer there? Chapter 2, verse 11. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was empty. No answers, you see. No answers in architecture, or art, or agriculture. No answers to the real questions of life. They're simply not there. It's a chasing after the wind. You never grab it. You think you're close, but then off it goes again. Nothing was gained under the sun. People are telling us very often, aren't they? If only people will find themselves in their work, in labour. That's what we ought to do. Get all these dull bludgers off the street and send them back to work. Then they'll feel important. Who are we kidding? Solomon says, I tried it. There's no answer to life there. I'm not saying it's wrong to work. We'll come to that in a minute. I'm not saying it's wrong to paint or being an architect. We'll come to that in a minute. But there are no answers there to the real questions that life forces us to ask. One last possibility, one last thing he put under his microscope in his experiment to find the answer. He looked to the future. See, maybe the answer is not in what we've done or what we've tried. Maybe the answer is in the next generation. We've mucked it up, but maybe they'll find it. In chapter 2, from about verse 12 on, he says, Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? Do you think my son's going to find the answer if I haven't been able to? What will he have that I haven't got if things just go round and round and up and down and round and round? There's no more information in this world if it's a closed world. If the only information you've got is what you see and think and are taught. No, he says, verse 13, I saw that wisdom is better than folly. I want my son to be a wise man. That's true. Just as light is better than darkness. Yes, I'm not despising philosophy. I'm not despising the intellect. I'm not despising learning, he says. Oh, far from it. Far from it. The wise man has eyes in his head while the fool walks in the darkness. But he says, I came to realise that there was no lasting answer there. The same fate overtakes them both. Now, see, this man, Solomon, if indeed it's Solomon who wrote the book, if he's the preacher, when he dies, when any wise man dies and his body is put in a casket and the casket's put in the ground, you stand there and you watch, you stand back a bit and you watch the burial take place. An hour later, a fool will be brought along and put in the plot next to him. What's the difference? At that point, there's no difference. Wisdom is good. Intellect is good. Architectural, agricultural, artistic abilities are good. But they won't answer the question because he says, look at the end. The fool and the wise man lie side by side in the ground. No, he says, I want my son...